All right, so then I will start the careers outside academia panel, and I'll start by asking each of the panelists to say a couple of brief words about themselves. So,
I'm first. My name is Michael Burns. I have a PhD in astronomy astrophysics, but I teach high school. I think I found the passion that allows me to apply my knowledge in a way that makes me very, very happy and passes it on to the youngsters to get to encourage them to study this amazing field of physics and astronomy.
My name is Michelle Irvin. So I have a BSc in physics from Guelph. And I am currently working at Google. I work as a technical writer, and I've worked as a tech writer. So Google is more software that I work on, but previously I was working for another software company called Ansys that does physics simulation, so computational fluid dynamics, finite element analysis. It was really cool. and before that, I was on the editorial team at Nelson Education for the grade 11-12 physics textbooks for the province of Ontario.
Hi, I'm René Stock. I'm working at Scotiabank. I got my PhD in physics, working in quantum information, so fairly close to IQC and Bremer, of course, in a sense, from topic-wise. Moved into finance about 8 years ago, started at Scotiabank, worked through various roles at Scotiabank. I got really interested in finance after the financial crisis, in particular working on new financial regulations. And so I've had the opportunity over the last 8 years to provide feedback on new financial regulations, work with other Canadian banks on that, work with the Canadian regulators on that, and also lead various teams within Scotia, and also bring in a lot of physicists into finance and help people transition into this career.
And I'm John Walgate, also have a background in quantum information with a couple of postdocs, one of them here, but left the field around about the same time as the financial crisis, did a bit of teaching, and then founded a very small sole proprietorship company to help in research development, help with research grant proposals and so on and so forth. Worked at that for a few years, and then transitioned to do it instead full-time on the staff side. So now I work for the Faculty of Engineering at the University of Waterloo as Strategic Research Initiatives Officer, which basically means a busybody to help boost the university's research funding, lobby government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a question around careers, broadly speaking, whether any of you faced what we refer to as the two-body problem of having a partner who also needed a job, and in that case, how did you deal with it, and did broadening your options in terms of what job you took actually help with that solution to the two-body problem? So, anyone want to start?
I can say when I got my PhD, you're so hot to trot on your topic area. And it wasn't, let's say, socially normal for you to have a relationship because you were bouncing around. In fact, I was bouncing around the United States and in Canada, going to different observatories at the time. I made a decision. In about 1986, I was involved with the Canadian government in helping putting up some satellite systems, and the Challenger disaster occurred. And I got invited to go and talk to all the high schools and the universities about what happened. There was a teacher on board when the space shuttle exploded, and that changed my life. When I got to talk to young people, specifically high school, it was amazing talking to college students and elementary school students. But high school students, they had a passion. They cared about what took place. That allowed me to step back and basically give myself a foundation. And once I had a foundation and a direction, then I was able to find a significant other, all right? But it took that situation for me to make it, because when you first get started, you're so excited about what's doing it, and your eyes are just wide open. And the last thing that I had on my mind was the significant other. Right?
Any comments, Michelle?
I mean, I have made choices about where I work. Google wanted me to move to the States, and I didn't want to do that for a number of reasons, but also, like, it's when you have someone with you, like, they can't also move and just get a visa. Like, mobility can be an issue for sure, but I think that you can negotiate, and there's always ways to find out, to figure out a common ground or alternate routes. And so that's what I was able to do with Google. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of companies that do have their head offices down in the States, but they have Canadian branches and headquarters as well.
Mm-hmm. I had heard, in fact, that Google has potentially moved a number of people from the U.S. who no longer felt necessarily comfortable because of their visa situations, and they have moved
rumors.
Them up to Canada. Is that a true rumor?
I think there are a couple of people that have moved up. There's definitely talk of that, mm-hmm. And I know there are some summits that we've been holding in Canada, because we have some people working in the Canadian office who can't travel to the States right now.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two-body problem certainly has affected my choice of location, in a sense that my other half has a faculty position in physics in the area. So in a sense, that is already a very strong kind of location and center around here. So Toronto was a very natural choice, and of course offers a various range of career options. Finding the right career, I think that has been probably the biggest challenge. Mm-hmm. I've gone through two postdoc positions in physics, being very committed to a career in physics. And since you've kind of committed, you've really got your heart set on physics, the hardest part is really to kind of convince you that there's something else out there that you'd like to be interested in working on. Mm-hmm. And kind of identifying that you can make a career out of that is kind of a challenge. What helped me was, in a sense, the financial crisis. I got more interested in finance, and I got more interested in, first of all, what went wrong from a modeling perspective, and kind of getting my heart set on that, and also seeing how you could influence that for the future, and seeing whether you could have an impact. And so moving into finance kind of became a natural kind of direction. I've started also a different degree. I actually did an MBA on the side for the first 3 years while I was working, just to kind of conclude that direction. And I really met a lot of interesting people, and so that just affirmed that direction more and more. So.
Mm-hmm. John?
Likewise, I mean, location is affected by this kind of thing, right? So I'm in Waterloo because at the end of my second postdoc, my partner was tenured at Waterloo, and that means maybe you should stay in Waterloo. So here I am. In my case, it's simply a question of priority setting, right? I didn't want to move. But I was already in a comfortable position that I didn't really want to pursue a career in physics at that point. I was clueless, so I can give you some tips on how to ineptly manage the two-body problem. if you are going to decide to put down roots and get a job outside academia in a country, might be an idea to start the permanent residency process nice and early, rather than waiting until 6 months before your postdoc ends, because turns out those things take time to process, and you get a bit of a hole in your resume. But it works out, right? I mean, it worked out fine with a little bit of creativity and thinking about what I had really enjoyed the most in my academic career, especially towards the end. Mm-hmm. Well, it was things, you know, working with teams, helping to develop and explore new research ideas rather than pursue perhaps one narrow one. And then looking for where you could find that in Waterloo, in my case. Mm-hmm. So,
And I agree. I think it's always a matter of balance and compromise and how you make those choices. And in my case, I had a job offer in Waterloo, and my husband was a computer science grad from Waterloo, and so he basically said, I think I can find a job back there. He's not an academic, so that made his choices broader, and was helpful. So my next question for you is, what skills do physics grads have that are transferable to other careers?
It's all about the data, right? We have been drilled with how to step back from our own personal preferences and just look at that data from a non-biased perspective. That is a skill set that can be transferable in any profession. And it's something that's very, very rare to have, because we naturally do have biases. And with our training and those labs that we've all suffered through, day in, day out, year in, year out, we've learned to look at a situation, analyze a situation, and with that skill set, we can apply that to a variety of subject areas. Financial is an absolute mainstay of that. You know, looking at data from a perspective that you don't know where it's going to go. And there are trends that people believe, but if we look at the data from the data perspective, that foundation that we have really tells us where it's going to go. And that's the best skill set we've got out of this profession.
Anyone else want to add to that?
Yeah, so from my perspective, I'm much more in communications now, technical writing. I find my background in physics invaluable, especially working with, technical systems, but the physics degree, like, you can look at a complicated problem, a complicated situation or system, and I think that the skills that we have is to really be able to step back and not worry about the complexity, but to just start looking at the tools that we have and how you can structure the information or learn about the different parts of it. And I really think that physics was really good for that, yeah.
I would really reiterate, actually, what Aspen said. I think looking at a complex problem, analyzing it, and presenting it in an understandable way also mm-hmm. is very critical and has been very important also in finance. Of course, data plays a role. Finance has a bit more, and especially risk management, and I'm in the derivatives market. There, of course, finance has played a role. Physics has, in a sense, played a role already for 30 years, in a sense that a lot of the equations, the mathematics underlying finance is very much tightly linked to physics. And so there's a lot of, adding to the two kind of main areas that were mentioned, but there's a lot of specific even skills from programming, from coding skills, development skills, Monte Carlo simulations, looking at real world data, interpreting it, coming up with a model to describe that data, and then executing that and using that potentially either for predictions or using that for analyzing risks, for example. That is very important. So there's very specific skill sets also that are important. Some others also in terms of communication, presentation. I think physics doesn't quite often focus on as much, but I've certainly had a lot of that also during, especially the postdoc years and during the PhD years in terms of taking that away, I think, into finance.
And I agree with all those points. I'll give a little left field addition though, building on what you just said about communication, because you don't always think of physicists or scientists as specializing in social skills, and maybe some of us don't. But one thing you do practice a lot as a physicist, as a scientist, some better than others, but you get more of it in that than most professions, is working on projects and providing constructive, helpful criticism. Just working together whilst never being satisfied with what other people have done. Always wanting to build on it and go further and drive things along and perfect whatever you're working on. And that can be a challenging thing to do, right? It can be an interpersonally challenging thing to do in a team. But scientists actually do that remarkably well a lot of the time. And that's really something you can bring to careers outside academia.
And I'll start with you. and ask, are there any other technical or personal skills that you'd recommend developing during graduate school or postdocs that might give you a broader choice of careers or strengthen your position when you go out and start looking for a job?
The one thing, I'll try and do a social skill one to start with. leadership or management experience, just to be very generic, is something you could easily emerge from graduate school or a postdoc without much of a track record in. So anything you can do that, and in a sense, this is sales pitch as much as skills development, but stuff you can do, you know, leading research teams or managing particular projects with particular clear deliverables, that would be experience that would be valued by people recruiting in industry, perceived as valuable. On the technical side, all I can do is get in first with a cliche, hype-driven answer right now. If I look at what the academics, or what the graduate students in the University of Waterloo are working on in engineering, where I'm employed, they're all about the machine learning and applying it to absolutely everything. It's taking off like crazy, and it's being driven largely by industry. All our industry partners, and we have hundreds of them, want to apply machine learning to their particular problems across a huge range of fields. So anything you can do to build up your knowledge in that and build up some kind of experience, track record of working with that kind of system would be great.
I should add for the audience that in terms of project management skills, for instance, one great resource that's available to most graduate students in Canada is the MITACS programs, and they actually offer a large number of courses that graduate students can take, and sometimes they offer them on a particular campus for a group of students, sometimes they offer them online, but they're completely free, and MITACS is effectively funded by the federal government to assist with the training of graduate students. And one of the things they do is offer skill sets that broaden the abilities of the students. And so I'd recommend that you look at the MITACS programs if you're interested in things like project management skills and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Anything else to add?
Yeah, I would say, as I said, specific skills would be also programming in particular and kind of iterating what John said in terms of data science, machine learning has become important. But even more important, just necessarily, quite often you might not have the chance to exercise that exactly, but what companies also are just looking for are really just the skill set that you can hit the ground running with programming skills. So I've worked in theoretical physics, which sometimes could make that somewhat difficult, so you might not have all that programming experience, but if you keep your research project fairly close to, for example, modeling an experiment, modeling real-world data, working with data, that gives you a lot of that experience that you can then transfer very easily to the industry, and that's a very specific skill set. I think that is very important. I think going a bit beyond just those specific areas, I think generally the different areas require very much specific skill sets. It's important to find out kind of what specific skill sets any area needs. So talking to previous graduates, what they kind of needed to get the ground running, what that employer might have been looking for, that's an important that's very important to find out. So depending on your interest, if your interest is finance, then one of the areas to look into is some of financial understanding, looking at derivative pricing, understanding some financial theory, understanding some basic economics, and starting to read up about that. Same thing if you're moving into any other industry, finding out what are those employers are potentially looking for, and connecting to previous graduate students and who have potentially started that career in that direction, and finding out what has helped them the most and what are they now looking for. So starting that through networking and trying to find that out for the specific positions also, or specific kind of interests that you have.
Mm-hmm. So you've led into what is effectively the next question, so I'll give you a choice of which question you want to answer. What are the best ways of finding careers outside academia as well as improving your skill set?
I would definitely take a look and see what's interesting to you, but try to set up information interviews if you can. Like, go and talk to people, try to find out different things about the industry. Because, like Renee was saying, like, there are specific skill sets that you might want to focus on for different types of industries. But also, some of the work that you can do even while you're in undergrad or grad school is kind of just like bridging that leap, right? So even if you would be able to pick up those financial terms and whatnot on the job, like, to show that you are interested in that specific sector and that you have done this work and you've talked to these people, I think that helps sell your skill set in that environment as well.
Anything
and I would say, you're doing the right thing. Go to conferences yeah. like this. This is exactly how you network. Today's technology is amazing with what Google has provided, no plug intended. But in the olden days, that's how we networked. We actually got together and we did what you guys are doing right now. You're coming to listen to people talk, you're talking to each other, you're finding interests, you are communicating. That alone will help you understand that people have discovered different paths. There are different great websites for physicists to get involved with. You can Google them, right? But they provide a network of jobs. Universities provide most universities provide a program to allow you to get involved with different areas, and businesses come in and talk to graduating students at every level. Mm-hmm. And I think universities, the fight is they want to hang on to students, right? Businesses want to make money. And so they're trying to recruit at every level. Mm-hmm. And a student will make a decision at what point do they want to leave academia and go into a money-making venture, right? Versus continuing their education. But yeah, for sure there is AIS and ASP, there's different great physics websites that are available for us to talk and communicate. Mm-hmm.
And I should say that often I think graduate students assume that the careers center at the university is set up for matching undergrads as they graduate with jobs, but in fact they're quite happy to match students at any level with companies coming in to interview. And so if you really think might be interested in a career outside of academia, that you might want to look around and see what there is. I think at the moment there probably, well, not at this time of year, but come January, there will be 5 to 6 companies coming onto the Waterloo campus each week from then until the end of April, basically looking to interview students who are interested in positions. And they usually give general talks as at the beginning of the day about the kinds of people they're looking for. So you would get a sense then of what kinds of careers there might be. So we have a few questions from the audience as well, and one of them is quite interesting. It's about the fact that the perception is that most jobs are advertised for engineers and not physicists, and then how do you get over that issue during the job search process to be able to highlight that as a physicist you have many of the same skills as an engineer? So any comments on that? Anyone find that an issue?
I'll start, actually. The funny thing is that the reason how I got my position in first place and how I got a context in the industry was because the job ad said physicists. Right. So I sent my very first and only application out because it said physicist, and I made my first connection and my first step to a network from that perspective. So that is still true. You still find some ads advertising physics in particular. That generally happens if the team that is looking for new people has already a physics background or there's some physicists around. That's kind of lucky in that case. But otherwise, I think if it's more geared towards engineering, I think taking the suggestion also earlier, arranging an informal interview potentially first, trying to talk to people in the industry to find out what are the skill sets, what are they looking for, and then identifying how you can align the skill set that you have with that position. And then highlighting that a cover letter is good, but it's most important in the resume to kind of highlight that you have that skill set and that will be able to transferable to the position, and also that you have the interest and the passion for that position and the interest for that position. That's very critical.
Yeah. Sometimes when I read engineering on a job interview, I just assume that means physics.
That's right.
But again, like, it depends on the job. Are they looking for a professional engineer? Like, I'm not a professional engineer. I can't build a bridge. Also, if you are looking for a job and you're looking at a job description that you are interested in, and it says engineering, like, apply. Never wait till you can tick off every single thing that they're asking for before you apply. And I would say that you have the engineering background if they're looking for engineering skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction that you made between looking for a professional engineer, somebody who has a PEng and therefore can sign off legally on certain things, versus looking for an engineering skill set. And the physicist skill set definitely overlaps with the engineering skill set in most cases.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing that the Canadian Association of Physicists has done is to introduce a professional physicist designation. Mm-hmm. And so you may be interested in actually considering writing the PPhys exam, which is offered at most Canadian universities once a year. And what it does is it forces you to apply your physics knowledge to a problem outside physics. So it might be a financial type problem that they pose for you as one of the questions. A second question is an ethical dilemma and how you would respond to that. And the third question is to explain some area of physics in lay terms. And so really it's a test of that you have some understanding of ethics, that you can apply your physics skill set outside of physics, and that you have some communication skills. And so there's the exam, and then once you have 3 years of work experience, then you get the professional physicist designation. And so it may be something that some of you may want to look into writing that exam, because it is offered at most universities, and then once you pass that exam, you only need the 3 years experience. And if you're a graduate student, your graduate student studies count towards that 3 years experience. So, what was the next question? So in academia, publications are extremely important, but in industry, how important are publications when applying for a job?
I would say it depends on the job. Academic publications in my industry it depends on the job. It depends on the job. If you're applying for a research position at a company, like, they might be incredibly interested in any academic work that you've published. For me, I mean, I have a portfolio of my work, and some of it, I mean, it's technically published through the different companies that I've worked for. And so that is important for my career, but those are not academic publications.
I would say in finance, unfortunately also, the focus is not on academic publications.
Yeah.
I think the focus though, and kind of to redirect the focus in terms of saying, if you do have quite a few very high level academic publications, and the importance of that is to show that you've had an impact in your field. And that you've had not only an impact, potentially also led to changes in the field or to new ways of thinking, and kind of how that can be transferred. So really showing that impact that you've had, I think that's important. It also helps, of course, to show kind of communication, writing, independent work that publications really help to establish. Potentially the team may know about publications, there may even be questions about the publication content, but I would say the most important part to look for is impact.
Yeah, agree. Because then, depending on the position, they're unlikely to be looking for you to publish papers in that job, right? So, and if they're not looking for you to do publishable research professionally, then you're not going to be selling your publications as your primary charm. If you can package them though as part of some tangible thing that you've worked on, which has had impact, has delivered something. That's the kind of thing people are looking for, particularly if you can make an obvious connection between that tangible thing and the tangible thing the company actually wants you to do.
Exactly.
Because ultimately, then the company isn't hiring you because they think you're wonderful. They're hiring you because they want you to do something specific. Mm-hmm. And that's what you really got to speak to.
And I think it is evidence of problem-solving skills in most cases, which we talked about previously. It's also, publications are often evidence of the ability to communicate, as was said. So I think in that sense, they do start to show that you have some skill set that will be important.
Yeah. And sometimes beneficial for the company as well. Again, specific companies, because they can use it for marketing as well. They can really show the industry that they're the leading edge. Mm-hmm.
Yes, if the publications are directly related to the area.
Yeah, exactly.
So, for instance, the machine learning area, as an example.
Right. Mm-hmm. And probably I've written more internal papers and kind of describing methodology and describing new approaches to how to do something in the industry than I've ever done in academic life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily that those skills are not used. They are used. They're probably put to daily use.
Yes.
In many, many positions.
Mm-hmm. I place a lot of my students end up placed in photonics companies, and they also attend a lot of conferences, the same conferences that academics mm-hmm. attend, because they're interested in some of the leading edge things that academics are interested in, and so you cross paths with them again. They're in industry and I'm in academia, but we still attend many of the same conferences for the same reason, to catch up on the latest techniques and keep up to speed. Mm-hmm. So, is it common for recruiters to present challenges or assignments on skills related to job openings as part of the application process?
That's a great Google question.
So do you mean like asking you to do exercises or?
I assume so. Yeah, okay, this was okay, a question okay. from one of the attendees.
I would say it depends on the industry, it depends on the company, and it depends on the role that you're interviewing for. So at Google, you do that. So I'm considered an engineer at Google, even though in Ontario that doesn't fly because of the professional engineering thing. So anyone in the engineering org, like working directly in software development, you are going through engineering interviews, and the writers, we do exercises beforehand. I think the developers, maybe they just do a, I don't know. I think maybe they might do an exercise before they come in. But there are definitely, like, you're showing your skills in an interview setting. At ANSYS, which was the physics simulation, I know some of my colleagues interviewed and gave presentations of some of their academic work that they'd worked on. I had a long set of interviews, but I didn't have to do a specific engineering problem in mine.
Yep. I'll talk to finance. Finance has been kind of infamous for presenting that type of problems, and there's entire books written on it that you can actually find that just a collection of all of the interviewing problems that people have presented. And so they generally consist of all kinds of like puzzles, statistics questions. There might be like some finance questions. Generally, just a lot of the times it's just problem solving questions. Now you might take that as in a sense to trying to answer the problem, but the point is not necessarily to just solve the problem or solve the puzzle. A lot of times these are on-the-spot interviewing questions, so they're not necessarily pen and paper questions that you just fill out and you solve the problem. The idea is that you communicate it and you kind of solve the problem on the spot in the interview. And so the interviewer is generally not looking for you to solve the problem. They're looking for your communication, how you approach it, how you approach the problem, how you communicate that approach, what questions you ask, how you kind of counter questions, and that general approach. So interviews tend to be fairly short, and within an hour, it's impossible to kind of try to assess how good a candidate really is. You have the resume, but you're trying to, in a sense, find out in a job situation, could you start a conversation about a problem, and would they be able to solve that problem? And would you be able to have a meaningful conversation with the candidate about how to approach the problem? Would they be able to come up with interesting kind of viewpoints, interesting kind of suggestions, and being able to communicate that also well? So it's much more than just the problem solving or the puzzle or the specific mm-hmm. kind of question.
It's about the interaction.
It's the interaction, mm-hmm. and also the communication and all the other skills that yeah. are part of the position.
Yeah, that's definitely, I mean, in our small way, not to the same degree, but we do the same thing in engineering. If we're hiring technical writing staff and such, like, they'll be set a task, and often a more or less impossible task, because you can set someone a task in an hour or half an hour, and yeah, you're not going to be able to do a polished job on it. But to the extent that it's important, which I'll come back to in a second, it's important solely because you want to demonstrate creativity. You want to see how it would be like to work with this person. What will they like when we've got a challenge and we need to collaborate? And what kind of inputs are they going to provide? You don't necessarily need to reach the solution. It's how are we getting there to start with? Mm-hmm. Having said all that, push come to shove, a portfolio, a body of established work, says a lot more than what you performed under, you know, half hour interview pressure and on one particular day. So the extent to which that kind of performance matters versus what you can demonstrate that you can do when you've got the time and build a body of work and then show it off to us, the latter is more important.
And my guess is, too, that if you're trying to show, for instance, that you have programming skills, that specific examples are more useful than just saying, you know, I'm proficient at this language. It's probably a better idea to say, you know, exactly what you have done as a project in that particular language. And
yeah. For sure.
Right. Now, from a teaching perspective, the interview process is two-tiered. Usually the first tier is you're a supply teacher. You're tossed into an environment, usually with very little prepping ability available for you, mm-hmm. but they're looking at how you interact with that situation, with the stress that goes along with that, how the students interact with you, how you interact with the students. That information is then forwarded. So when you actually apply to become a teacher at the school, you're panel interviewed. And having a portfolio is fundamentally a requirement. They actually demand that you bring one in. And each panelist has a specific area that they're interested in asking you about. Mm-hmm. They're trying to make you to demonstrate your skill set, your communication skill set, how you would handle a variety of situations. They seem to have a database of the worst scenarios you could ever yeah. imagine, right? That will never happen in real life, but they toss these things to you to see how you would react under pressure. Mm-hmm. They take that along with the practical experience that they've seen you done, you provided through your practice teaching. And from then they make the decision. But communications, and we've all said this, right, the ability to communicate well, the ability to handle situations that you're not necessarily comfortable with, that is what they're looking for. Mm-hmm.
And I would say in the scenarios, because in some of the interviews I've been involved in, we bring up the scenarios, and it's important that the person shows some kind of depth of thought, you know, that balances the possible reactions to a particular scenario, that they're not just coming down and saying, no, I would absolutely do this, and that's probably the wrong
exactly.
approach. It's much better to talk through it from the pros and cons
of
two different approaches and to show that you're thoughtful about these scenarios, I think, is the most important thing. So the next question I have is, as a disabled graduate student, academia is often too quickly paced and filled with hoops like poorly accommodated coursework and doesn't pay enough to afford the treatment and assistance that this person needs to function properly. The private sector, however, seems to make hiring decisions in large part through subjective evaluation of short, high-pressure interactions with lots of potential for accessibility challenges and possibly unintentional discrimination. So does anyone have tips for navigating job acquisition and retention as a disabled person? So I'll put that out and say, you know, how would the process of interviewing and assessing a candidate be modified for someone with a disability, for instance?
So I know at Google, and I want to say that maybe a bigger company would be better at handling, like would have the scale and have the HR department to be able to have mm-hmm. specific practices in place, but I'm not saying anything against any company, mm-hmm. and I don't know specific situations. But I know that Google, if you talk to your recruiter and you would be working with a recruiter through the whole process, like they would be setting up and modifying any interviews or exercises in a way that's accommodating to you. So I don't know details mm-hmm. about specific situations, but I would talk to the York recruiter and be honest about what modifications are needed and what would be the best approach for it. Because the recruiter wants you to be successful too, right? Like they're there to get you in that job.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what Michelle mentioned is certainly true. I think most companies will have procedures in place to kind of address that and also allow you to kind of, the candidate and the person to self-identify that during the hiring process so that the accommodations can be made. And generally, even if the hiring team might not have the experience for that, generally there is an entire HR department that deals with that situation and tries to help that team to make the accommodations and try to provide that. That's generally if you contact the company directly. I think most companies would have a way of self-identifying. I think there was a lot of discussion this morning already in some of the diversity session about whether you would want to self-identify. And so there were some interesting discussions around that. I think in this case, I think most companies, especially larger companies, would have that in place, and it would likely be beneficial to do that. Also, working with a recruiting company or a placement company, I just talked very shortly to our HR department. They did, for example, recommend like Career Edge Canada actually has specific services and a specific internship that would also, for example, consider that and consider that also in placement and also make sure that during the hiring process that would be considered. So there are certainly options out there. I think also there's, in terms of placement and recruiting companies, I think they should be able to help with that situation.
Yeah.
And also then after the hiring, of course, from a workplace accommodation, large companies have to provide the proper environment.
That's right.
But also making sure that the actual role and responsibilities of that specific role are potentially even adjusted and any accommodations are made around that role.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that the whole issue of accommodation has changed over the last few years. Certainly in Ontario, the laws have changed dramatically so that, that companies don't have a choice about making these accommodations.
Yeah.
So for instance, the University of Waterloo now routinely asks any candidate for a faculty position whether there are any accommodations that need to be made. That's, you know, a routine question in the letter that goes out, you know, telling them what they need to bring with them when they come for the interview. And I think most companies are more aware of these issues as well. And it's also important in terms of self-identification to remind people that all that you have to specify are the accommodations needed. You don't have to talk about anything to do with the health history that is associated with that. It's only the accommodations that have to be actually...
That's a good point.
Yeah. Described.
Also, to your point earlier, if you're still on campus, like go and access whatever recruiting or work placement like groups there are, because that might be a good space to be talking about this and to be figuring out some strategies or even how to talk to recruiters, because I'm sure they'd be able to walk you through a lot of this as well.
And they might also have some experience about which recruiters from which companies have
Absolutely.
Been more sympathetic in the past.
Yeah.
If they see a fairly large number of students going through interviews, they may have a sense. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm a little saddened to hear that the coursework was poorly accommodated, because I thought that that had also improved at most universities, and I'm sad to hear that for this particular person it hadn't improved.
I've noticed that it's starting at the grassroots. Like I've noticed it went from the elementary school to the high school, like the accommodations that we provide, the government has mandated that are provided for students, is amazing now. And it's slowly making its way up. It's a very expensive thing for large institutions to incorporate, but it is making its way up, and times have changed. It's like in the last 10 years, we've made major headway.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that it's always easy to navigate within a large institution. Yeah. That's one of the issues.
And bureaucracy is always there.
Yeah. So, and HR departments are usually trained to handle it, so that's usually the best point of contact.
Yeah.
And the rest of the question is, does anyone have tips for navigating job acquisition and retention as a disabled person? And could you suggest fields or types of positions that are able to be flexible or accommodating both in hiring practices and methods of doing the work?
So that's a tough one because, you know, if you can do the job, you can do the job. And if they provide the accommodations necessary for you, then most companies won't impede that. They're mm-hmm. either legislated to that, or they're mature enough to understand that you're an asset for them. Mm-hmm. And as an asset, right, they will do whatever they can to retain that asset.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on?
I would maybe suggest approaching that in a similar way to approaching like what skill sets are needed in industries too. Like go and talk to people, go and have some information interviews, find out what's involved and what the different companies are like. I mean, we can talk about a specific industry versus another, but a lot of times it really depends on the team that you're working with, the specific culture in a specific company, which may vary company to company or team to team, even within the same company. Mm-hmm. So yeah, just go talk to people and ask questions.
Yeah, I think environment is critical, I think, and it's very important to make sure that you feel comfortable and contributing and you're appreciated for the work that you're doing. I think so the environment is, I think, critical. Finding out about the environment, I think, is an important step. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the best to, in a sense, you can judge potentially during the hiring process somewhat, finding people to talk to and talk to as many people that may have an experience, for example, or with a specific company or a specific industry. That would, I think, be certainly, I think, the best way to navigate that.
You've really got to talk to the people in question because it's not even an industry. It's not an industry-wide problem. It's not even a company-wide thing, right? It's the group you're working with.
The responsibility now has become company-wide, which is interesting because it's more easily handled by the company as a whole than it is by the individual group. But you're right, the accommodations that are needed may vary with the group and the particular work. And I think for a lot of companies, it's more about ability now than it is about disability. And so maybe the best approach is to always try to remember that. It's your abilities that count and that your disabilities should be accommodated for if you have the abilities that are needed for the particular job. So we've touched on, as we went along, some of the ways to find out about careers, talking to people, but that's kind of a broad statement, you know, go talk to people. And so how do you find the people to talk to? How do you start that networking process of talking to people in various industries? I've noticed, for instance, you know, I collaborate with people in industry, and very often identities of people in a particular company are fairly closely held. You know, it's not obvious who they are or who you should be talking to. Any hints on how to start that networking?
I would probably say recent graduates, first of all. Like, so people, if you know somebody who has moved from this particular, from the university, from this research group out into a non-academic area, I think that's a starting point. This panel is a starting point. Anybody on this panel might know somebody. I think the point is just to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. Quite often, that person may link you to the career or the interest that might be most aligned with what you're interested in. Whether it's data science, we may know somebody. If it's about innovation, if it's about, for example, innovation policy, for example, or how to affect, for example, government and economic policies in terms of innovation or research, people have moved into those areas. So there's a lot of different, there's many, many different career areas, and people tend to be, people that have moved outside academia tend to be also connected to some extent to others. So quite often they can point you in the right direction, even if it's not the right, even if it's not quite the career you're looking for. But at least start talking to people, start talking to recent graduates and build it from there. It's certainly, I think it's certainly, as a making that first contact is quite challenging, I think, and starting that, but it is, I think, one of the most critical steps.
Yeah, crucially, you don't have to solve this problem all at once, right? Yeah. You don't need to identify the senior person in the industry that you want to contact and cold call them. But you can build up in baby steps when people you know, connections, just one step removed, and widen your net, right? So that you're open to conversation rather than focused on one.
Well, and tonight may be a good time to start, so you may find that you're in great demand when we start the reception part and the poster viewing. You may find lots of people coming up and trying their skill set out on you in particular. So I'm assuming everyone on the panel is very happy to have those conversations. Yeah, I'd like to open to the floor now for any additional questions. Although, okay, so I can take one from Aggie. I'm having difficulty seeing because of the lights, so I may actually need some help figuring out who's putting their hands up, but I can see Aggie's hand there.
Is there an optimal point in your academic career to make an announcement for that
moment? I started working right out of undergrad, and I did my master's part-time while working. I think that it can depend on where you're at, what your interests are, what you want to be doing out in industry.
And what your goals in life are.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I'm fairly sure my postdocs added my second postdoc in particular, added very little to my career prospects. I enjoyed it immensely. I had a good time. So I don't regret it in the slightest. But it depends entirely on what you want to do next, right? If you desperately want a massive, great career, I mean, there's a sense in which the sooner you jump, the better, right? Because the sooner you start building up very relevant industry-specific experience. But that doesn't mean that's the path you have to take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the same. I think somebody actually asked me at some point of whether it would be worthwhile doing a physics PhD to get that placement in finance, because the PhD in particular helps. I think you should be doing a PhD and you should be following the physics career because that's your passion and because that's what you enjoy doing. And you do that as long as you can sustain it and as long as you're happy and as long as that really gives you also the options and kind of the perspective that you need. I think you follow it as long as possible. And of course, what's important also here to say is really, we, in particular, for example, looking at women and diversity, it's important that we keep women in academia. Drawing basically that away from academia is not necessarily good, of course. I think setting that example and basically creating this environment in the academic environment is very critical also for the industry and for the longer run. So I think there's not necessarily an ideal kind of jumping point. I would say you work as long as you're enjoying what you're doing, and that might be master's, it might be undergraduate, it might be two postdocs.
If you're really interested in industry, assistant professor is probably a step too far. Just because it's not worth it.
But you know, the other thing is that we haven't talked very much about academic careers, but for academic careers, there are hiring cycles of, you know, more availability of academic careers over some time points, and then less availability, and then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, the market opens up a little bit, or agencies like NSERC introduce bridging programs. And right now is one of those times when NSERC's talking about, you know, there's not much hiring going on, and maybe they should be introducing some kind of bridging program to bring people into academia. We'll wait to see if that actually happens, but I think that also influences people, what time of career you're at versus what the market for academic careers looks like versus what the market looks like in industry. And that's going to influence decisions as well.
Plus the economy plays a major role, because sometimes you're presented with an opportunity that you didn't even know existed. And usually, you know, everybody gets into the field, most of us get into the field because we want to continue our way up there. But when the opportunity does arise, right, don't be afraid to gamble, right? I tell my students, the best time to take chances is when you're young. You're already in debt anyways, right? You've got very limited financial responsibilities. Most of us don't have houses or cars at that point. Yep. So go for it, right? And if it works out, fantastic. But you'll discover that it's an amazing place out there in the world, and you will find things that you never knew existed within your field. It's you know, just go for it.
Yeah. It's also possible to do internships, MyTax is another source of these, while you're doing a graduate degree, so to try out the waters of what you think a particular industry, whether it would suit you or not. And I've had graduate students who've done that and discovered that certain industries they knew they weren't going to end up in. I've also had students who thought they were going on for a PhD and some company came into the lab to talk about a project and poach someone away, yep. who had no intention of going to industry. So it is serendipitous sometimes as to how people end up in various jobs.
I would actually also say that the timing actually that was mentioned is a very important point. I remember when I'm in physics, when I tried to find out which field I was most interested in, I moved into quantum information when it was a very, very young field. It was exciting, it was changing, it was moving ahead, and you were talking to the people that were some of the first people working in the field. And so it was very exciting. I kind of relived that when I was moving into finance, because the financial crisis just kind of re-examined how the financial industry works, how, for example, regulations work. Things were changing very quickly. And moving into a field that is very changing, very fast changing, first of all, it allows you to have an impact. It allows you to kind of experience, contribute to it, haven't contributed, and also build your career in that. So if you're looking right now, certainly finance is still a very interesting area. Things are changing. I think the addition of machine learning, data science is adding a lot of possibilities in a lot of industries. Certainly starting in that right now is a very interesting field to move into. So timing is very important. And the timing aligned with your interests and developing the right interests, I think, at the right time. That, I think, probably determines it more than even, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Anyone I'm not seeing because of the bright lights? No? Okay, so then we'll wrap this session up, and I'd like to thank our very interesting panelists for their contributions. I think that they had some very helpful things to say from your point of view, and certainly I found it very interesting. So please join me in thanking them. Thank you.